No, I like talking about the book because the book was the whole process of like finding an agent, writing a book proposal, all of that. And there was, you know, it was a five year thing.
So where did the idea come from? Like, what was the motivation behind it?
Well, the motivation came from my history of how I got into the medicine to begin with, was that I think one of the missing points in health and in healing is diet, because it's both, you know, it's both a cause of illness, but also a remedy, right? And the American diet, I think most people will agree, just sucks. No, I mean, it started out, we had this idea for the book, and I think at that point, Mika wanted to involve somebody with sort of gravitas in Chinese medicine. And so Yuan Wang came up because she was like senior doc at the hospital in Chengdu. And she had the most sort of, I don't know what the word would be, but sort of panache or something. Or she just had the most power behind her in terms of, you know, her word is sort of gold.
Yeah, she's like the authority on.
Yeah, and she really is, you know. In that the other Chinese docs respect her because of what her position was in China. So, and then I already had a good relationship with her. And then, so we involved her. And then Mika attended the Maui Writer Conference in Maui just to learn how to pitch a book to an agent and a publisher. That was the reason. It was a nice vacation also.
Hey, we have a podcast. I'm here with Warren, co-author of the cookbook Ancient Wisdom, Modern Kitchen. We're going to talk about food, food therapy, and what it's like to write a book. So, Warren, thanks for being here.
Oh, it's great to be here.
So I do want to talk about your book, but first I want to ask you, how important is food or dietary intervention when it comes to patient outcomes? I mean, because I think you have this quote in your book that's like, if a person is sick, first use food and adjust their diet. If that doesn't work, then you give them tea. If that still doesn't work, then you give them acupuncture and herbs. So if that's true, are we as practitioners putting enough emphasis on food and dietary changes when it comes to outcomes for our patients?
No, we're not, number one. And number two, I mean, some of this is culturally based, right? It's like people don't come in to change their diet. People don't want to change their diet. You know, if that were the order of things, we'd never be doing acupuncture.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? So yeah, I mean, you know, food is it's essential. I think the core, it's one of the cores of good health, but it just isn't perceived that way in our culture. And everybody, you know, it's really hard for people to shift on their diet.
Have you found anything that works really well in terms of getting patients to shift their diet?
It's a lot easier to add things than it is to take things away.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot.
Yeah. It's like, it's hard to get people to just give up things. And especially if they're in any kind of a family setting where they're doing it and everybody else is not doing it. And that's immensely challenging. Adding things.
So it's like, it's kind of easier to say, add in one steamed vegetable every week. That's a lot easier than cut out ice cream.
Yeah. Cut out sugar or white flour or whatever it might be.
But do you think that, I mean, because you're in the clinic and you see students and you see patients, do you think that conversation needs to happen more often? Or do you think it's just a futile thing that it's not going to happen, so let's just stick needles in you and call it a day?
I think both. Yeah. I think both are true. It has to happen. It may be futile. But at some point, there has to be some kind of a conversation about how the patient's responsible for their own health, that you're not there just to fix them. There's some kind of a symbiotic relationship going on.
Yeah, like you have to meet halfway.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're part of the process.
Have you ever had that conversation with your patients about you need to meet me halfway? Or I guess maybe another way of saying this is, have you ever fired a patient or refused treating a patient because they refused to meet you halfway? Like, I'm not going to give you herbs until you change your diet?
No. Yeah. I have a hard time playing that kind of a parental role.
The bad cop role?
Yeah. It's probably why I was never a parent. One reason. It's even harder with my dog, you know. I can't say no to my dog. Yeah, and the dog does not meet me halfway either.
So I don't know, let's talk about your book, because I really like your book. I recommend your book to a lot of people. I feel like your book is half TCM theory or half or three quarters practical recipes that people can follow along with. I feel like it's a good book not only for practitioners, but it's a good book for practitioners to recommend to their patients if their patients want to get into eating healthier. So again, what was your motivation behind writing that?
Well, that was actually the goal. That was the goal. Like, and there was a discussion, you know, with the publisher on this also. But yeah, the goal was to have it be a useful book for patients, but to also to have an introduction to Chinese medicine, to herbs, diet, and all this kind of a thing, and then make it practical as, with recipes. You know, the one thing when you're writing a book and you're writing a book proposal, you have to make a case for how what you're presenting is different than what's already out there.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I feel like there are other Chinese medicine
food
books.
None of them have recipes that are written in a cookbook-style manner that people want, that a publisher insists on nowadays.
Yeah.
I mean, that written in the exact format of a recipe, because a lot of people are into cooking now. And just to say, oh, you know, cook up some rice and then add some, you know, that doesn't fly. You know, it's a good way of getting people not to do things. Whereas actually having the recipe orderly, in order, the ingredients, little tips on how to cook, that kind of a stuff, that really gets people to cook.
Yeah, because I've been watching a lot of YouTube channels that are like historical cooking, 18th century cooking, Cooking with History by Max Miller. And it's kind of funny that sometimes they pull out these old books and the recipes are like, take a good amount of flour and mix in some milk and then beat three eggs. And it's like, how much flour? How much? And I feel like I've seen a lot of Chinese recipes that are like that too, where it's like there's no ingredient amounts. Yeah. There's no, the descriptions are very vague. So
yes. And ours are crystal clear. Every recipe was tested probably 10 times along with the instructions, you know, so that it, and then tips on how to do it. So that it just makes it easier for the patient to just step by step cook it, because the rest of the books are all like that.
Did you have like a focus group that was your test group who went through all
the recipes? It wasn't a focus group, but we would send recipes out. I would send them out to some of the students at Pacific or friends and get feedback on it, and literally feedback, I guess. Yeah, food back.
Where did the recipes come from? Were they like family recipes?
Yeah,
Yuan's?
Yeah, some of them were from Yuan. You know, so there are actually some really a few authentic, good Sichuan things in there. You know, but also just some good health stuff. We got a hold of Mika's grandmother's cookbook, and her family's been actually taking care of a Buddhist temple in Japan for like 900 years. The grandmother's family. So there were a number of recipes that we actually used in the cookbook from that, and then some from her dad, who's from Japan. Some of them are just altered, or actually just like there's Shengbaisan is in there. Yeah,
like basically just taking a formula and then turning it into a tea that people can cook.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or like just plain old Swanzoren, you know, sour jujube tea. You know, how to grind it up, how to make it, how to use it to help you sleep. So things like that.
Oh, I've been seeing a lot of people on Facebook posting their pictures of Swanzoren and they don't grind it first.
Yeah.
So I have to
tell
people.
And it's like so hard.
It's like it's useless if you don't grind it first.
Yeah.
But then what I always say is like, if it's true, if you use a mortar and pestle, it just doesn't work very well. It's going to take you hours to grind that
up. Yeah, and it'll bounce out too. You know?
Yeah, yeah. So I'm always like, just get a cheap coffee grinder. You don't need like an industrial herb grinder, but just a coffee grinder works pretty well.
Yeah, just a little spice mill. It's great.
I don't know. What else about your book?
It's a real challenge to get a book published. I'll say that. A lot of people think, which I think is why people just so often, especially in our field, self-publish. You know, because the publisher's not going to publish anything that they don't think they're going to make money on.
Yeah, and I would imagine they get like hundreds of pitches every day. Like you had to make yours, like you said, stand out.
Yeah, and we got two really good offers. It took some time, a few months, but we had an agent. So the thing is that, and I forget the exact percentages, but remember, we got some books on how to publish a book, and one of them I think said there's like a 5% chance of getting your book published, but if you can get an agent, it's like a 95% chance. So, but then you have a small chance of getting an agent, because an agent's not going to take your...
Oh, yeah, you have to pitch to an agent before you can pitch to
exactly.
a publisher.
Exactly, yeah. Right. So, you know, Mika's the writer, right? And she's a great writer. So she wrote a dynamite book proposal. That's the first thing you do, is you write a book proposal. As a matter of fact, one of the publishers that we didn't go with said it was the best book proposal that he had ever seen.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So you really need to get to write a book proposal first, which is this whole, the need for this book.
Yeah, like the value proposition and the positioning.
Right, exactly, yeah. And the examples of the writing and all this kind of a thing. And then it gets pitched to publishers. And we got a couple of good offers.
You don't have to answer this if you don't want to. Like, is there a lot of money in publishing a book? Because I feel like I've heard other people say it's like you're making pennies when you write a book.
Yeah. So my understanding, which actually comes from Mika's best friend in New York, who's an editor at HarperCollins, a senior editor at HarperCollins, is that most first proposals, especially first books, lose money. So, and I think like, I remember what he said. He said 5,000 books for a first book is a lot.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and we've done a lot more than that. So our book actually did well by some that comparison, yeah.
But I feel like I've heard some people say it's like you don't make money on a book. That's why you book all these speaking engagements and you go on tour and you actually make more money doing that. Whereas the book, it's like you make 5 cents and the publisher takes the rest.
Yeah, it used to be that way with like record albums, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you make the money on tour. But yeah, people don't, you really have to hit the home run to make the money with a book. Because basically, and I forget the exact numbers, I think we make 8.5% on the cover price.
And so what was the writing like? Was it mostly Mika doing the actual pounding the keys, or what was the writing process like?
Well, it has to be,
like?
Because I'm a horrible typer, and she types over 100 words a minute or something. So, yeah. Yeah, I mean, first of all, there's three of us involved, right?
Yeah.
So I don't think I've ever been involved with a project where years later we still get along. Mika Mika, I live with Mika, but Yuan and Mika and I get together for dinner, whenever we're in San Diego, and because they just really love each other. And so Yuan was sort of the source of the gravitas, the Chinese medicine. And I was sort of the editor into English of translating Chinese medicine language. And then I did a lot of research also. And Mika wrote it, in terms of the typing and some of the idea stuff and some of the framework stuff, because she'd already done a lot of writing. So it was a real good collaboration, excellent collaboration.
What's your favorite recipe in the book?
That would have to be the mizutake. Yeah, it's a Japanese soup. I think it's originally from like Fukuoka, which is like west, I guess it's the Sea of Japan there. It's a city that's south of Korea, like Busan in Korea. And so it's a mix of like Korean and Japanese influences in the soup. And it's a hot pot.
I don't think I've made that one. Because I'm remembering, I can remember like the silver wrapped fish and the zitsuye chicken the shrimp with goji berries.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
The sesame balls. I think the sesame balls are my favorite. I would make those for my herb classes when we'd talk about food
when
therapy.
When we did book talks, we made the sesame balls. It's like just because they're so great. And then Mika developed an allergy to sesame. So no longer. But those things are great. Yeah, but I'm a soup. I love soup, and I think soup is really easy to get people to cook, and it's very healthy for sick people, older people. So, yeah. So that's my favorite, and it's actually her dad's favorite recipe too. So.
Oh, nice. So so it's one of those family recipes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she grew up eating that. But there's so many. I mean, God, I don't know how many recipes, but there's a lot of good ones, and then some of them are sort of traditional Japanese, like almost. Macrobiotic in nature.
So I have a couple food-related things I want to get your opinion on. And I have my own opinions, but I want to hear what you have to say. What do you think about kanji?
Oh, kanji's great.
You like kanji?
Yeah. Now, I mean, it's not everybody should be eating like a bunch of white rice.
Yeah, yeah. I guess that's my thought. Is I see a lot of people in clinic that whenever they have someone come in that they think has spleen qi deficiency, they'll be like, oh, you should eat congee. I'm like, I don't know about that.
Yeah, I don't eat white rice, ever. I haven't had it in years, so I wouldn't recommend it to a patient. So, you know, that's a cultural thing. You know, in East Asia, that's what they eat. But, yeah, I mean, I eat quinoa. I mean, theoretically, you could make a congee out of quinoa. It's more of a seed.
Yeah, no, and I guess that's the thing is, like, when you go about, like, congee, sometimes it's like these people come in and they'll say, oh, you should eat congee. I'm like, I'm not sure they need, like, a high glycemic, easily digestible carbohydrate source.
Yeah, that's how I feel.
I mean, it's one thing if you have this really deficient patient that they're really sick and now they have a low appetite and they have a lot of nausea, then yeah, maybe that's true. But if you have an overweight pre-diabetic person that with a swollen tongue and a soggy pulse, you don't necessarily need to give them white rice.
Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah, probably not the best idea. And like I said, I don't need it, you know, for that reason.
Is true spleen qi deficiency really that common?
Yeah. If it means incomplete digestion. Yeah, I mean, if you sort of broaden the definition of it to not completely digesting. And, you know, how many people do you know that are taking probiotics or taking enzymes, you know, because they have digestive problems? So they're sort of adding to the digestive process because their digestion's not working well. So that's what I think. How many people do you know that have loose stools because their digestion sucks?
I guess my thought on that, like, is it really that their spleen is deficient, or is it that they're shoving too much stuff on top of it? So I guess when we see this, what's our proper treatment strategy? Like, do we really need to give all these people sejunsetong?
Yeah, no, yeah, that's a good point. Maybe we just need them to stop shoving all that stuff on top of it.
I guess I'm asking you leading questions where I'm trying to get to.
No,
like,
that's good.
I like Ping Wei San way more than I like sejunsetong.
Yeah,
most
yeah,
of
no,
the time.
I like that. Yeah, yeah. But I think, you know, that brings us back to the diet, right? It's like, you know, stop eating all that crap that's going to overwhelm your spleen. There's no way it's going to handle that, you know, at all. Do you know what I mean? Which includes overeating and.
And like at that point, is it kind of worthless to give someone herbs?
I think so. You're taking like two steps forward and one or back, and then you're taking one step forward and two back.
Yeah, because I've had people ask me this. They're always like, do you take herbs? And I'm kind of like, well, no, because like I have a really pale tongue. I have loose stools and things like that. But it's like when I'm eating a box of Oreo cookies every night, I'm not sure the herbs are doing much good for me. I'm probably not digesting those herbs.
Yeah, but then
once I stop eating the Oreo cookies every night, it's like everything's better and I don't need herbs. So
Yeah. Easily addressed through the diet. And I'm not sure. Let's say the herbs are nice, but you know, I think that's fighting a battle that's not easily won with a much stronger opponent with those kinds of dietary influences.
So say you get a patient come in, they're vegetarian or vegan, and you diagnose them with blood deficiency. What kind of food recommendations would you give them?
Oh, boy. So first of all, you know, I see what students do all the time, and maybe practitioners, is like, go out and eat a steak.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you know, this is not what Chinese medicine says. Chinese medicine's a small amount of meat, strengthen your spleen. Spleen builds blood. If you don't strengthen the spleen, you're not going to build blood, right? If the spleen isn't already strong, right? And then whose spleen is going to handle a giant steak? You know, it's just. So it's about balance at that point, you know. Eating a little bit of meat, eating greens, you know, the red foods, beets, right, to nourish blood. But all being very mindful of what the spleen can handle. And what your digestive system can handle.
So if a person doesn't want to eat meat, do you think that eating greens, eating beets is going to be sufficient to build blood?
Oh, God. Yeah. The eternal question. Yeah.
Are there any other options that we have, or should we just give them herbs? Or because I'm thinking like a lot of people say, oh, you should just eat greens. But I mean, even if we're just looking at like iron content, like the amount of spinach you have to eat, like sure, spinach is high in iron, but the actual amount you have to eat in order to get a daily allowance of iron is like,
right.
you need to eat like 5 of those big bags. Like nobody, when you say eat greens or eat beets, nobody eats that many beets.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
And can their spleen handle all that, all those greens beets anyway?
It's ridiculous. And then you get the oxalates and everything else. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, there's always there's supplements.
Yeah.
People supplement. I think if you're a vegan, I think it's wise to supplement. You know, and my teacher was like adamant. He was Chinese. This is a Pacific, right? You're only going to get it through red meat. And I'm not sure how much of that is true or how much of that is cultural. So,
or I guess sometimes I think how much of that is true anymore. Like maybe that was true 100 years ago, but maybe now with our food choices, we can kind of circumvent that a little bit differently than we could before.
Yeah, I mean that's possible. You know, because I mean obviously our ability to just have good nutrition is it's right at hand right now.
Yeah, or it's like I can just go out and buy vegan protein powder and.
Right.
Where you couldn't do that before. So I've had people ask me this, both students and patients have asked me this, but I've had people ask me, what's the best diet, or is there such a thing as a Chinese medicine diet? What's the optimal diet according to Chinese medicine? So if you had a patient come in and ask you that, what would your response be?
You know, I think, first of all, it depends upon the person, right? What's the best diet for you isn't going to be the best diet for me, hands down, right? Because we treat people according to how they present, what their pattern is, and what their needs are, but generally speaking, whole grains, fresh vegetables, and maybe from a Chinese medical perspective, a small amount of meat, maybe 10-15% of the diet. But to be honest, I think that's what the perspective is. I'm not sure that's optimal health wise. Do you know what I'm saying?
Like, in terms of meeting individual needs or
adjusting
to the patient's constitution?
Yeah, I mean, there may just be a cultural bias for a lot of that.
Maybe that's another interesting thing that we bring up, because a lot of times when you talk about food therapy, one of our go-to things is don't eat dairy. That dairy is going to form dampness.
Yeah, where do we get that from?
Is it just Chinese people are lactose intolerant?
I don't know, but there is nothing. No, I say that's not in our books. It's not. It's in Le Jabber. But, I forget who it was, I think it might have been Bob Flaws writing about that, saying that that's just patently not true.
That there's actually nothing in the classics or even the modern books that actually says don't eat dairy. Dairy causes damp.
Yeah. But I think too much dairy can cause damp. I think, anecdotally, we see this all the time. For myself, I see that. But not for everybody. And for Northern Europeans, as you pointed out, compared to like... Chinese.
And actually, like, kind of along those same lines, when you talk about raw food, I did find this interesting note by Nigel Weissman that when one of the books, when it said avoid eating raw food, he had a footnote that actually said, here, when they say raw food, they're actually talking about raw meat. So it's not about it's not about eating raw vegetables. It's like if you eat raw chicken, you will get salmonella. That's what they meant by don't eat raw food.
Yeah.
But then, to be fair, in that same paragraph was also don't eat cold food. So it could be that some of those raw vegetables fall under the category of cold food. I don't know. Maybe you already kind of touched on this, but I feel like when it comes to nutrition, a lot of people focus on small details. They're like, oh, I'm going to eat blueberries because they have antioxidants, or I'm going to use coconut oil because those medium chain triglycerides are digested differently than other oils. And I feel like with a lot of those things, it's like people, they're looking at the trees and they forget the forest, or they're majoring in the minors. So
it's the superfoods. They want the superfoods.
Is there such a thing as a superfood?
I don't know.
It's like if it has less nutrients, can't you just eat more of it? what do you think are the big picture things that people should focus on rather than getting caught up in the details? What are the big picture things?
Yeah. First of all, just in terms of your diet, I think it should be interesting and fun.
Oh, that's interesting. Like how?
I think that the part of the problem culturally is that we don't have a healthy relationship with our food in terms of eating it, in terms of like appreciation, of course, in terms of different flavors, different tastes, just having fun with it. Really, it's and then being mindful when you eat. All of that is in some ways, like the first step. to having a healthy diet, regardless of what you eat. You know, I mean, we approach, you know, the people that are like diet fixated, we approach it sort of like we have this sort of puritanical, dogmatic, religious thing about food, and it's just like, you know, that's not a good way to create an open, warm relationship with your system. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's kind of like, although there's almost this like moralistic view of food that there are good foods and there are bad foods.
Yeah, and so make it flavorful, whatever that is for you.
If you eat chicken and broccoli, you're a pure, noble person. Whereas if you're eating takeout pizza, that means
not in my world. You know, it's like, So I, you know, make it flavorful, make it interesting.
And so we can still have it be fun and flavorful, but also healthy and supporting the body.
Avoid a lot of the crap, you know? It's like, you know, it's like, what does Michael Pollan say? I forget what he says, but you just, you know, it boils down to just eat a small amount of food, mostly plants, you know, that kind of a thing. And then have fun with it is my thing, you know, enjoy. But don't eat things that, you know, don't buy packaged food. You know, I mean, part of the problem in our culture is that people have become totally dependent upon packaged food. So you go to the supermarket and the whole center of the supermarket is like packaged food and frozen food that's packaged. And it's only sort of the edges where you get the vegetables and the dairy and whatever, you know. And so 90% of the supermarket is packaged food. And that's so 90% of what people are eating or more, you know, has like 5, 10, 20 ingredients. It's like, yeah, it's mind-boggling. And just to keep it simple, you know, basically if you're going to buy packaged food, it's just to have like a, you know, 3, 4, or 5 ingredients at the most. You should know what they are.
So what do you do with your food to like keep it simple but also have it be fun and exciting?
It's been interesting, especially during the pandemic, you know, because I make curries, right? It's very simple.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and like I said, I'm into quinoa now, so that's... It's basically the grain / seed of choice, and I always have that on hand, and then I make different curries, different sauces, things like that. Fish, wild fish. We do some organic poultry.
Yeah, I was gonna say curry is like a really easy way to keep things interesting because it's really easy to switch out. You can switch out your ingredients, switch out your proteins, switch out your sauces. We're talking packaged food, but there actually are a lot of good pre-made sauces you can use, too.
Oh, there's a organic Thai curry that I'm using now. It's called Mike's Curry Love. It's out of Thailand. It's made by a chef. And it's completely organic and vegan. And it's a little pricey, but it's freaking awesome Thai curry. It's like restaurant quality. You just add coconut milk. We have spices in our yard. We have lemongrass. We have, you know, I forget what else. Kefir lime tree, you know, so I add stuff. You can add a little bit of, galangal or whatever. It's really easy. And so it's really easy. I don't cook anything that takes more than a half an hour. And then you have something for like the next day or the day, 2 days later or whatever. And you just, you know, keep on making it. But you have to be willing to like invest, from my point of view, 30 minutes. That's it. Yeah. If you're willing to eat frozen food also, that's another thing.
Oh yeah, how do you feel about frozen food?
I have mixed feelings, you know. It's like I used to be like religious against it.
I've been really into frozen food lately.
Yeah, and then somebody at Pacific that was teaching there, I won't use his name just because, but he's a good guy. And he came up with the idea that he said, when you're buying vegetables from the supermarket, they've been sitting there 1, 2, 3 weeks before you buy it, right? And they were probably picked before that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, like before they were ripe. They're picked before
exactly.
They're ripe.
Same
and
with
then,
fruits, right?
Yeah,
right.
So...
But if you buy it frozen, it's picked and frozen. So which one has more chi? You know? It's arguable. So I'm totally into frozen foods now. After he said that, I was just like, okay. You know what I'm saying?
I feel like they've even done studies on that in terms of nutritional content. I mean, I guess if you think about chi, it's maybe a little bit different. But I think in terms of nutritional content, I think, they've made that argument that...
I like the argument.
Yeah.
You know, so he just changed my mind on that.
Yeah.
In a good way. because it frees you up a lot too.
Yeah, but I feel like that is one of those things that people get really dogmatic about, where they're like, oh my God, you eat frozen food.
Yeah, or,
oh,
that
you
used
eat,
to be.
You eat non-organic food.
Yeah, that used to be me, but not no longer. Yeah. My sphincter has loosened, I'll just say that. You know.
And then you were saying that a lot of the stuff is easy to do, like it's maybe only takes half an hour to cook or something like that. Does that ever frustrate you when you like when you run into your patients who like refuse to change their diet or they complain about how hard it is? Do you ever just like,
yeah.
No, it's actually easy.
I say that.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like, you know, we're at a place, it's like, you know, this expectation, for instance, that people are going to cook herbs. Okay. Now, like I have a friend in Boulder and he his patients actually cook herbs because it's Boulder. Right. Okay. But in many major cities or wherever, you know, people don't even cook their own breakfast. You know, they'll just, you know, blah, 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 slam something down, have coffee, and they're on their way. They won't take the 10 minutes to cook breakfast. So who's going to take 40 minutes to cook herbs? It's an unrealistic expectation culturally, in my opinion.
And I guess that's the same thing I think about congee. Like, are you really going to get Americans to boil their rice for 2 hours to make congee?
Yeah. Difficult. Although, you know, I'll tell you what simplifies things is the Instant Pot.
Oh, yeah. Do you like those?
I love that. Yeah. It even has a sterilize function on it. Do you know that? Yeah. There's a thing, you know, that, I don't know, mine's like a 9 function. One of them is the sterilize. And you can sterilize, you know, cups, needles, whatever in there. Yeah. But yeah, so that's how I'll make my dinner. Not dinner, breakfast. Like, night before, I just put some steel cut oats in there, some water. And then set the timer, which takes 5 seconds. It's not like one of these old style timer things. It's very intuitive. You just have to basically set the time. And, you know, and then the next morning it's ready and it just stays warm until you know, open it. So that makes things easier. And theoretically you could use that for herbs too, for like supplementing formulas that are going to get cooked for
Yeah, because I feel like I've done that with, like, not an Instant Pot, but, like, with a pressure cooker or things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
I've
yeah,
done stuff
yeah.
like that.
Yeah, it's easier with the Instant Pot because of the timer on it. And the different settings. Different settings also.
I don't know. I'm running out of energy. Anything else about food we should talk about?
No, I mean, yeah, I can't. It's interesting. You know, I wish people would just try different things, you know. It's like The other thing is to experiment. To just, you know, it's like encourage your patients to experiment.
Oh, just instead of being stuck in a rut, like try some
yeah,
new things.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually why we wrote the book, so you could actually, you know, print out the recipe, you know, and say, here, you know, try this. It's very simple. It'll take you 20 minutes, and it tastes good, you know. And you know, it's got herbs in it or whatever, and it still tastes good. We left out one thing about the book. We left out lots of stuff that would be in a Chinese medicine book from China, like, you know, the pig's liver and the, you know, whatever else.
Yeah, chicken feed and...
Well, chicken feed's fine, but yeah. But, you know, worse than that, yeah. So tried to make everything taste good. That's the thing, is people will not... People are, you know, that's one of the problems with raw herbs is that oftentimes they're bitter and people, you know, they're afraid of that. So... But there is a way of making the food taste good. I mean, this is, you know, I think food should somehow make a smile come over your face, you know. So, and it should be interesting, and things should have different colors and different flavors, and the whole the Chinese medicine rainbow, you know, the five elements.
And so could we say that's one of the ways that distinguishes this TCM diet is we're paying attention to the five colors, the five flavors, and we're trying to balance that mixture?
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. I just think people respond to that emotionally also. Yeah.
Is it easy to adapt that to different styles of cuisine? Because I feel like that's like a really big emphasis in Thai food, that they want a variety of colors and flavors. That's a really big thing in Chinese food that you often start with.
It's a combination. More about like Japanese food also.
Yeah. When you have like soy sauce is salty, vinegar is sour. Yeah, you have the acrid of the ginger.
Yeah.
Do you think that's possible? Like, can I cook Italian food that has all five colors and all five flavors? Have you ever tried that?
Well, you probably could cook, I haven't tried it, but it's in Northern Italian foods. Sure. I mean, God, come on. All the vegetables or, you know, Tuscan or, you know, how maybe not with like spaghetti and meatballs, but, you know, yeah. Yeah, Italian, the actual Italian food is wonderful.
And so I guess what I'm getting at is, like, if we want to follow these TCM principles, do we have to eat a Chinese diet? Do we have to eat stir fry? Is there a way to adapt that to?
There is. I mean, you're not going to adapt it to like an Eastern European diet. But certainly with diets where there really are a lot of vegetables, you know, whether it's Mexican or you know, parts of Spain or Italy or, you know, where there's really vegetables going on, you could do it. Yeah. And lots of different flavors too. But the American diet, the Canadian diet, the English diet, maybe not so easy. But in California, you know, where there's lots of vegetables. Yeah.
Do you have anything else? Anything you want to say about your book? Anything?
What is there to say about the book? It's a fun book. What can I say? But I think the book actually reflects the fun that we had in writing it.
Yeah, I was going to say, was that like a stressful thing with a lot of deadlines? Or was it like...
It was moderately stressful, but there was a lot of fun involved. And the testing and tasting of the recipes and coming up with the little sayings and just the fact that the three of us got along so well and would socialize around it and eat around it also. We'd go to Yuan's house and she would just like, you know, make all this food and she's an amazing chef. So there was that whole sort of healthy process around the whole thing, which I think is reflected in the tone of the book.
And was there a lot of tweaking of the recipes? Because I'm just imagining, like, if Yuan makes something, she just probably just throws things together and it turns out well. Yeah. Did you have to, like, videotape her and be like, oh, that's like a tablespoon of soy sauce or...
No, we try things like 10 times and literally. Because the recipes in the book are very precise, like any cookbook would be. You know, so with, you know, directions, steps 1 through 10 or whatever, and the ingredients and the exact measurements and tips on how to cook it and everything. And so we had to try them multiple times to get it into a working recipe format, which of course is what makes it different from any other books of its type.
But I imagine that was a process just because it's like your source material.
Yeah, some of it was pretty sparse. Yeah, Mika's grandmother.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, she had a funny one for like how to make pickled, what is that? They put in like they have in the sushi, like a pickled mackerel. It's like first you get the, then she go through the whole pickling process, and then you hang the fish for 2 weeks outside your door. And of course, this is all originally in Japanese. It was translated. So, yeah. We didn't have that one in the book.
Yeah, that's. Does the book have like a website or an Instagram or?
It's got a Facebook page, Ancient Wisdom Modern Kitchen. It's got a website. I think it's ancientwisdommodernkitchen.com.
Oh yeah, no, you have some good sample recipes on ancientwisdomcooking.com. Yeah. So.
Yeah, on the website there's sample recipes. There's the Breathe Easy Pear. Remember the Breathe Easy Pear? That's one that you know with the Tuan Bei Mu, the fritillaria, and the pear. No, there's some good recipes here on the website. The color purple yam is actually that's really good. It's like purple yam, and sweet, and it's really good recipe.
Oh, nice. And some ramen. Oh, yeah, there's some good stuff on here. So
yeah,
even if you just go there and look at it. Yeah.
Yeah, those are, yeah, some of them are not in the book. Eat Shoots and Leaves, Springtime Soup, you know that?
I don't remember this in the book, but did all of them have funny names like that, like punny names?
Some of them did, yeah. She had Flurry of Curry and Mushroom Menage. We just came up with names that were quirky and some of them funny. But, you know, some of them actually have some actually more meaning to them. But I wanted to make one of the kanjis that was for diarrhea. You know, which has like lienzi, you know,
like lienzi and xianshi, and
yeah, those kinds of food herbs in there to stop diarrhea. I wanted to call it "Stop the Poop Soup," but Mika wouldn't let me do that. Yeah, and there's a good introduction to sort of food herbs in here too, and the nature of food, just from the beginning of the book, where there's like, you know, basically, 50, 60 pages on. You know, different foods from Asia and their cultural background to the food, the Chinese medical meaning, the entering channels, the taste, temperature, all these things of the foods, like 100 foods.
Yeah, because as I say, I don't have my copy in front of me because I actually gave it to my parents and never got it back. But I do remember that it's kind of like one portion of it is just recipes that are easy to follow. But the beginning portion is if you're interested in that theory about the taste temperature and the effects of food that sometimes you might see in some of those in the other books. It does have a section on that, too.
Yeah. And then it has all the 100 Asian recipes, Asian ingredients. And, you know, what the entering channels would be and maybe a little bit of history behind it, you know, wherever it might, the source text of it, these kinds of things. And I should say that we really sourced our information, and I can't say that for the other books, in terms of like history of like getting books, people's dissertations from the history of Chinese foods or foods in Asia. Botanically, we sourced things. You know, so that we know that things like E-Ren, for instance, Coax, you know, where it comes from, what its botanical origin is, and that it's gluten-free. It's not barley. It isn't related to barley. It's called Chinese pearl barley, but it's not barley and doesn't have gluten in it, you know, because we sourced with science books also, so... Because Mika was working at that time at Scripps Research Institute.
So. Yeah, so it's not necessarily like, oh, this is a Chinese person. This is what they said. You actually have resources and references for everything.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. Because sometimes you get a lot of that where it's like, you're not sure if this is just one person's opinion.
Yeah. Or if people just make stuff up, and I don't like that. So. So we did. Whenever possible, we just would try to source things. And there is a bibliography in the back, and we sourced things. We bought a whole library of books to write our book. So Mika read Unschuld cover to cover. Yeah. And she had no background in Chinese medicine. Yeah, so you know that's where we're coming from. Before writing the book, she read Unschuld and a bunch of other books.
Oh, no, that's really cool. Because like, it's such a fun book. It's kind of weird to think that, like, oh, this was like, it's also a serious research book, too.
As a background, you know, so, yeah, yeah. So you're not just pulling it out of your lower burner, so to
speak.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. The lower part of your lower burner.
So let me ask you this, because we were talking about herbs, and this is going to be a question. This is something that came up, and I was going to ask Patrick. I figured Patrick would have a good answer for this, but maybe you have a good opinion. Can you learn Chinese medicine without learning herbs?
You can't learn internal medicine that I know of. You learn channel medicine, and you could do, you know, but herbs, I think you learn all about the. You know, the interaction of the organs and the pathomechanisms and, you know, and the disease process, right? I would say no, you can't.
Did you ever get those people in class that like straight up, I don't want to learn herbs? Because I feel like some of those people like, I'm here to be an acupuncturist, not an herbalist. Yeah.
And that's fine, but you're not going to really learn, you're not going to be helping people on a very deep level, I don't think, you know, so...
Yeah, because sometimes I would try to make this argument that even if you're not prescribing the patient herbs, what you're learning in your herb class will be applicable to your acupuncture treatment.
Yeah, because that's where you learn, you know, about sort of how disease happens, you know, and occurs and the process of it and the pathogenesis of it, you know, and you know, causes and, you know, everything, you know. I mean, even if you just read the Formulas and Strategies book, you know, the Eastland Press text, you know, the Volker Scheid thing, you know, then you learn, you know, you just learn read the commentary, and it's so rich with all that stuff that you don't, where do you see that in an acupuncture text?
Yeah, because I was even thinking even things just like heart heat pouring into the small intestine.
Yeah.
I feel like we never talk about, like you don't really discuss that in an acupuncture class, but it's a big deal when you're talking about herbs.
But you could apply that to the acupuncture, but the understanding's not going to be there. Yeah, no, of course, you know. I mean, you name it, any of the Zangfu patterns even, you know, the real depth of understanding comes, especially the more complex patterns, through the herb book.
This episode can be downloaded at podcast.tcmstudy.net/session11. As always, thank you to the Patreon members for supporting this podcast. If you'd like to join them in their support, you can go to podcast.tcmstudy.net and click on the donate button at the top. But that's all for today. We'll see you next time.